call the next case, please.
Department Store Stand versus Virginia Department of Taxation. Craig B. Fields, Michael A. Newmark, Nicole L. Johnson, William L. S. Rowe, William H. Wright, Appellant Counsel, Elizabeth Bushnell Myers, Assistant Attorney General, Stephanie Ann Lipinski, Galland, Harold Johnson, Appellant Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Sandy Rowe. I'm a member of the Virginia State Bar. With me today at table are Mr. Mitchell Newmark and Mr. Craig Fields, who are members of the New York Bar. They have been admitted by the trial court pro hoc vice to this case. And with the court's permission, Mr. Fields will argue the case for Coles.
All right. Glad to have you.
May it please the court. My name is Craig Fields, and I'm here on behalf of Kohl's Department Stores. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Four?
Yes, please.
I should let you know that that microphone is not primarily for amplification, it's for recording, so you need to speak up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, we believe that this case is a straightforward case involving the reading of a tax statute. It involves one tax statute and one stipulation. The statute is Virginia Code Section 58.1-402B8A, and it is two sentences long. It's two sentences. It's part of it is on page 11 of our brief, part of it is on page 3 of the department's brief. And the first sentence in the statute says that a corporation is to add back any intangible expenses that it pays to one or more related persons to the extent that the corporation deducted those in computing its federal taxable income. The second sentence, which is the key issue here, is that this addition shall not be required for any portion of the intangible expenses if one of three safe harbors applies. And the first safe harbor is a safe harbor that is at issue here today. And that safe harbor provides that the corresponding item of income received by the related member is subject to a tax based on or measured by net income or capital imposed by Virginia, another state, or a foreign government with a treaty with the U.S. The stipulation at JA032, stipulation 26, provides the royalties that Kohl's Illinois received from Kohl's were subject to a tax based on or measured by net income or capital in each of the separate return states. And at JA031, paragraph 21, there are 9 separate return states. And we believe that application of this unambiguous statute to the stipulated facts demonstrates that Kohl's...
Now, to the extent that the statute has the phrase subject to and also has the word imposes, which seems to be a fulcrum for the argument here today. There's another stipulation, and it's page number 25 of the stipulation. Each of the separate return states imposes a tax based on or measured by net income or capital. And 26, the royalties that Kohl's Illinois received from Kohl's were subject to a tax. I think what you're telling me is that the stipulation actually answers the question and does not leave anything left to interpret under the statute.
We believe that is exactly right, Your Honor. We believe the clear reading of the statute, the clear meaning, the plain meaning of the statute applies here, and that the stipulation controls. When you apply the facts to the law, There is nothing to interpret. There is nothing to construe.
Well, now, I certainly wouldn't hold you to this, but if it were not for the stipulation, it would appear that you might not be correct.
I think we would still be correct, Your Honor. But because of the stipulation alone, we are correct. And the statute provides that this addition, second sentence, shall not be required for any portion of the intangible expenses if one. It doesn't say to the extent one of the safe harbors applies. It says if one. And then it also uses the word any portion. And the state's position is that only the portion of the royalties that are actually taxed. But the term any portion means no portion is added back. Not 5%, not 10%, not a proportioned amount. No portion is added back. Any means all. And the statute as a whole confirms that. You look at the what we call the conduit exception, which is the third exception. The third exception has two requirements to qualify for the conduit safe harbor. The first is that the related member paid such portion of the intangible expenses to a third party. So when the General Assembly wanted it to be a portion, they used the term such portion, wanted a piece of the whole. But when they want the whole to be, they use the term any portion. And if you look at the second part of the conduit safe harbor, it uses the term any portion. It says, the second portion, that the transaction does not have as a principal purpose the avoidance of any portion of the tax due. So in one sentence, the General Assembly uses the term any portion twice to mean everything, and they use the term such portion once to mean a piece of the whole.
So your point is that the expression subject to taxation is an idiomatic phrase in the tax world, and it just means what it literally says. It's subject to taxation, and whether the tax is imposed in full or in part is another subject. It's another subject entirely.
I think in this case, I think the tax has been imposed. The stipulation agrees with that, and I think the tax was imposed. And I think the term imposed also looks to the type of tax that is imposed. So the sales tax would not be included. It's based on that income. And then who is imposing the tax? It must be Virginia, another state, not states, another state, or a foreign country with a treaty. And so it would not qualify if tax were paid to tax was imposed by a foreign country without a treaty or by a city. As we believe the plain meaning of the statute controls, the department, neither below nor here, has argued that the statute is ambiguous. We do not believe it's ambiguous. The circuit court did not find the statute ambiguous. Indeed, the circuit court ruled based its decision on the plain language of the statute, and so said at JA 113. If this court were to hold that the subject to tax safe harbor only applies to where tax is actually paid, our alternative argument is that tax was actually paid not only in what we call the separate return states, but also in the combined return states, as well as in the add-back states. And the statute says the corresponding item of income is subject to tax. It doesn't say the tax had to be paid by the related member. And in a combined report, the tax is also paid on the income received by the related member, in this case, Colstrip, Illinois. And in the add-back states, it is also paid on the royalty. In North Carolina, they have a statute that allows taxpayers to elect to either include the royalty in the recipient's tax base or to have the royalty payor deduct. It's an election, but in either instance, the royalty is subject to tax. And therefore, we believe that in either the separate return states, the department agrees, we believe the add-back states and the combined reporting states as well, subject to tax exception, safe harbor would also apply. If you don't have any further questions, I'd like to reserve
the rest of my time. You have 6 minutes, 36 seconds.
Counsel, I do have a further question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Looking at the 2014 and 2016 Appropriations Acts, the provision that relates to this that was put in by the two money committees and put into the budget begins, quote, notwithstanding the provisions of 58.1-402B8, end quote. What does that initial clause mean?
I think there's several pieces to that, Your Honor. First, it means that that budget bill, the first budget bill from 2014 and the second budget bill from 2016, provided that notwithstanding the statute that we're talking about today, that only a portion would be subject to the subject to tax safe harbor. The 2014 budget bill expired in 2016. The 2016 budget bill expires in 2018. And I believe application of either of those to us would be unconstitutional because it's years after we filed the suit and had our vested right in the refund claim, as well as 7 years after first year at issue in this case. But I believe both statutes support our case. It shows that our reading must be correct.
Okay, so this is actually going to be identical to the question that you heard me ask in the prior case. Can we, under our statutory interpretation rubrics, can we look at what was put into a budget bill subsequent to the statute being enacted, in this instance in 2004, as indicative of the General Assembly's intent or how the General Assembly would want us to interpret a prior act?
Well,
the Solicitor General's answer was yes, we can.
I think if you get to the construction of the statute, then you could do that. But I think here you don't even need to. The plain meaning of the statute controls, and the plain meaning of the statute, as this court has said in Signal Corp, in this Commonwealth, courts are required to apply the plain meaning of statutes, and we are not free to add language nor to ignore language contained in the statute.
In my few years on the court, though, I've learned that when one side says plain meaning means it's black, and the other one says the plain meaning means that it's white, that it's often gray, which equals ambiguous. So if indeed we were to find it's ambiguous, can we use the budget bill for purposes of eliminating any prior ambiguity?
Your Honor, I believe you could. I believe if you were to find this statute to be ambiguous, not only could you use that, you could also use the fact that the General Assembly three times considered revising this exact statute and declined to do so. Twice it was proposed to change the word if to the extent, and both times the General Assembly did not do that. The third time, the proposal was to add such portion two times into the statute, and the General Assembly again rejected that. And so I think all of that together confirms that the reading of the statute that we propose is the correct reading.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 3 minutes, 13 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. If it please the Court, I'm Stephanie Ann Lipinski-Galland, and with me is Elizabeth Bushnell Myers from the Virginia Attorney General's Office, and also Hal Johnson from Williams-Mullen. I also am from Williams-Mullen representing the Commonwealth and the Virginia Department of Taxation. We believe this bill is a clear interpretation of an anti-abuse statute, which was enacted by the General Assembly in 2004, 58.1-402-8A. We are also going to discuss 8A1, which is the exemption that's attached to the imposition of the add-back statute.
Can you, at some point in your argument, address the impact of the stipulation?
Yes, sir. Do you want me to do it now? All right. The stipulation that my opposing counsel references is number 23, and it is SJA. I apologize. It's stipulation 35 within the stipulations, and I did not jot down what the JA was on that, and I apologize for that, Your Honors.
What number did you say?
It's stipulation 35. If you look at 35, Your Honor, there are two types of taxing states in this country. There are separate filing states, and then there are apportionment states, right? And a separate filing state, to which Virginia is a kind of a hybrid of, only the company that is doing business in that state, whether it's part of a combined or unitary group or not, only that company can file an individual return. So if they're in a combined group that has five related companies in a separate filing state, each company must file its own return. It cannot combine anything. It must file its own return. In this particular case, Your Honor, Coles Illinois, which is the related member referred to in the statute, files in separate filing states, right? And stipulation 35 clearly said that to the extent that Coles Illinois filed in those separate filing states and paid subject to tax imposed and paid the tax, the Commonwealth's auditor gave them a full credit for the measure upon which they paid tax. This statute is unique in that it adds back the measure, the taxable income, not the tax, it adds back the measure. And so whatever measure was the calculation upon where Coles Illinois paid tax in that separate filing state, the department gave them the credit for that. So that's kind of a red herring in that they say, oh, well, you know, Coles Illinois filed paid taxes in those states. The inference is we didn't get a credit for it. Coles Department Stores, who was the payor, didn't get a credit for it. And nothing could be farther from the truth. Because if you look at the audit, which is part of the record as well, but you look at stipulation 35, it clearly says they were given a credit for the measure of tax that they paid in the separate filing state.
Now, I don't see the use of the word credit.
Well, they don't, Your Honor, but they received
the exception.
They were allowed the exception. Okay. So it's the exception is the credit. Were given an exception from having to add back that measure to the add-back statute.
Well, what does stipulation 25 and 26 have to do with that?
26, Your Honor, was that they were given credit equal to the income upon which they paid taxes. 26, I'm afraid I cannot remember 26, Your Honor.
26, the royalties that Coles Illinois received from Coles were subject to a tax based on or measured by net income or capital in each of the separate return states.
Yes, sir. If you look at how this matter was filed, it was talked about Coles Department Stores, Coles Illinois, and then the combined. So 26 mirrors 35 in that Coles Illinois was given an absolute dollar-for-dollar credit on the measure that they did, that they filed, where they in the states where they filed and were subject to a tax imposed, they were given that credit, Your Honor. That's the exception worked exactly the way the General Assembly wanted it to. This anti-abuse statute that was the add-back statute that was enacted because corporations were playing what I call baby games. They were taking the income from one company, Coles Department Stores, creating a special purpose entity that they put the intangible company into, and they were paying payments to this intangible company. This intangible company did not file in all states. It doesn't file in Virginia. It was located in states that had either incredibly low tax rates or no tax at all on this type of income. And so what you can do, what you see is Coles Department Stores took a deduction off their taxable income, right, for the monies that they paid to Coles Illinois, shifting that income off, taking the deduction, thereby reducing their taxable income upon which the calculation would be done. And then Coles Illinois was taking the money and not paying tax on it anywhere else.
So the General Assembly says if it's subject to taxation, it could be within the safe harbor. But what does that expression mean if it doesn't mean simply that it is subject to taxation as opposed to the extent it was actually taxed?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at our brief that we filed, we specifically say that there is this to be imposed, to have a tax imposed, to be subject to a tax in a state and then be imposed, that tax be imposed, there's a thing called apportionment. And the United States Supreme Court has gone to great lengths to understand with the growth of multi-state companies. Think going back 20, 30 years ago, there were not a lot of multi-state companies. But as they arose up, there had to be a way of splitting the baby across states so that each state could actually tax the value or the income that was earned in that particular state. If not, what you had is if a multi-state company said, we made $1 million, that each state where the company was active in would say, ooh, we get to tax $1 million. And each one of us gets to tax $1 million. And at the end of the day, the poor company is paying more than it should across all state lines because everybody's taxing the same value. So the Supreme Court came up and it said in Container Court versus the Franchise Tax Board that what we're going to do is we're going to create this thing called apportionment. And apportionment is this calculation that says we're going to look at where you earn income in this state, and by a calculation, we're going to say you earned X percentage of all of your income within this state. And that is what is going to be subject to tax, and that's what we're going to impose tax on. One of the things that Kohl's Department Stores is trying to confuse the matter with is this apportionment thing, where they say, and Mr. Fields referred to it at the end, we have this, we are putting it on our combined state's returns. We're taking the income from Kohl's, Illinois, and putting it on this combined state return. The issue is, again, the Supreme Court, very clever group of people, obviously, said, you know what? We see the game that's being played here. And they specifically said in Shell Oil, and I have to reference the site, I'm sorry, Your Honors.
Well, that's a huge train of interpretive inferences to drag into the expression subject to taxation.
Well,
because the ordinary expression, I would think, would just mean you are subject, as opposed to dollar for dollar, you are specifically taxed, and it's been imposed to that extent.
Well, Your Honor, the statute says subject to tax imposed. It doesn't say subject to tax. Let me give you an example. You obviously have seen the sealed record that was handed to the justices, and that is the copy of all the tax returns upon which Kohl's Illinois and Kohl's Department Store, they have filed those with the court. Might I point out to you that if you look at SJA 02, and this is a perfect example of what I'm talking about. If you look at line 11, it's the Virginia income tax return for Kohl's Department Stores.
What page again?
It's SJA 002, the sealed portion. If you look at line 11, you see Virginia taxable income, right? Virginia taxable income. The appellate tries to confuse the words taxable income to subject to tax. But if you look at this, you've got taxable income on line 11. But then if you go down to line 16, it says income subject to tax. When you get down to that, that's where the tax is imposed. And unfortunately with tax, which I must admit, most people and most of my family and my friends, when I say the word tax, they kind of run away or go out the door or something, because it gets so layered and complicated. All of this stuff is proved out when you look at a return, right? When you look at the return, that's where you see that sometimes the word taxable income up here may be a huge amount, and as in the case of a combined return, it's pre-apportionment income, which includes everybody in the unitary group, is on that line. It's not until you get through the apportionment analysis, and go back and remember, apportionment analysis is the thing that recognizes how much tax is actually, or excuse me, how much income is actually earned in that state by that company, then that's when you get into the lines that actually say, and here's what we're going to impose the tax on. They don't impose the tax on the big amount up here that's the pre-apportionment combined group. As Shell Oil says, and the United States Supreme Court said in Shell Oil, it is not just putting it on that pre-apportionment line that says taxable income does not mean that it's subject to tax, which brings us back around to our statute that says in order for you to get this exclusion and this exemption, more importantly, you have to show us that you had this measure that you paid to this related company who's not paying taxes in our state, right, is going to be subject to a tax imposed. During the 2 years period that this case is addressing, Your Honors, the related entity, Kohl's Illinois, paid less than 1% of $800 million it received from Kohl's Department Stores. Everybody, common sense plus the constitutional issues, can see that what is happening is they are making an attempt to siphon off income over into another state where no taxes are being paid.
Now, counsel.
Yes, sir.
After July 1 of 2014, with the 2014 Appropriations Act, that was no longer the case. Is that correct? That resolves it, resolves the issue from the date that the fiscal year 2014 began. Correct?
Your Honor, I would say yes and no. The department's position is that the 2014 language was clarifying language.
I'm getting there.
Yes, sir.
I'm getting there. But the whether it was clarifying language or not, it stopped the bleeding of tax revenues, so to speak, beginning with the first day of the fiscal year 2014. It made it quite clear that you're going to be, the tax is going to be imposed on Coles, Illinois for the use of the intellectual property from that day forward. Is that correct? Do I understand the import of the Appropriations Act?
I believe that is true, Your Honor, but both parties in this matter have by stipulation said that the 2014 clarification language is not applicable to the matter before the court today.
You're not allowing me to get to the question that I think you know is coming. And that is that it says, so the General Assembly's intention was from 2014 forward, this ain't going to be an issue as long as we include this in the budget bill. And they've now included it in two consecutive budget bills. The General Assembly, though, in doing that, said, notwithstanding the provisions of the act that we're arguing about today, we're now going to collect, we now are going to make sure that we get the tax. So by saying, notwithstanding the provisions of 58.1402B8, one way to interpret that is that the General Assembly is conceding, we didn't do it right back in 2004, but we're going to do it right now in the budget bill. Now, that would be the way that they would want us to interpret the language, notwithstanding the provisions of 58.1402B8. How would you ask us to interpret that particular clause, the notwithstanding clause?
I believe that the General Assembly, understanding that all of the litigation that has been brought up because of individuals trying to play the left-hand, right-hand game, perceiving that they thought that subject to tax and the imposition of tax gave them some kind of a gray area, as the court has already said, that this is kind of a gray area. Obviously, we have two groups saying. I think the General Assembly just at that point said, you know what? We had it clear. We thought it was right. We were getting rid of this loophole. Now, clever people have tried to find gray areas, and we've got a lot of litigation. We're basically going to make sure that we plug it 100% and that nobody has any questions. Your Honor, one of the biggest... I apologize, Your Honor.
You can answer my question. The difficulty is that they were capable of doing that without saying, notwithstanding the statute, here's what we intend starting with FY14. And it's the notwithstanding language that has me tripped up. It's almost as if the General Assembly is saying, hey, we acknowledge that we're not able to get it beforehand, but we're going to get it now.
I think the General Assembly, Your Honor, again, this was clarifying language in response to all of the litigation that was out there, and that they saw that an example like that I gave you of the less than 1% of more than $800 million over a two-year period was absolutely mind-blowing to them in their budget deliberations, and they just wanted to put this thing to rest forever.
Okay, so if it required clarification, was it ambiguous? Is the statute ambiguous?
I do not believe the statute is ambiguous, Your Honor. It says, if we look at the impact statement that was done in 2004, which, again, is part of the legislative record. We're not just looking at the bill. We're looking at the legislative intent, which is part of the impact statement, which is part of the legislative record. It clearly said our goal is to stop this hemorrhaging, this baby, some baby games that are going on, and we are doing that. It is inconceivable in my mind that the General Assembly would pass a bill to lock down these loopholes and then ever suppose that the word subject to and imposed would be somehow misconstrued, that they weren't saying if you want the ad back, you have to pay tax on the measure of the company who's receiving it. We do not want nowhere income. And I kindly ask the court to look at the decision in the Alabama case in Surtees to see a very learned discussion on this subject matter. I thank the court for your attention, and we ask that the court please uphold the decision in the circuit court. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Rebuttal.
May it please the court. The department spends a lot of time on apportionment in its brief and enduring argument, and apportionment comes after what's happening here. What we're determining is how you compute and what is included in Virginia taxable income, and that's statute section 54.1-402. Allocation and apportionment come after Virginia taxable income has already been determined. It starts in section 58.1-406, which says a company is doing business in Virginia and outside Virginia, then the company shall allocate and apportion its Virginia taxable income as provided in sections 58.1-407.
But their point, of course, is that the apportionment regimen presupposes their interpretation of 402B. I mean, that's their argument.
I think their argument is that income action has to be taxed, but I'm not sure I follow you.
Go ahead.
The department spends a lot of time on abusive situations, and the General Assembly realized there could be abusive situations, and so it's specifically stated in the statute at issue here at 58.1-402B8C that nothing in subdivision B8 shall be construed to limit or negate the department's authority under section 58.1446. And under that statute, the department has an arsenal of weapons to go after abusive situations. And indeed, at JA047, in the record, the department acknowledges that it has used it and does continue to use that section to go after abusive situations. And there's nothing here that the situation at issue is abusive. Coles pays substantial taxes to Virginia. If you look at SJA001, line 9, it shows for 1 year it paid a substantial amount of taxes to Virginia. Coles, Illinois is not a special purpose entity. Coles, Illinois is an entity domiciled in Illinois. It's not a Delaware holding company. Illinois is not viewed as a tax haven. The company has significant salaries. It has hundreds of millions of dollars of salaries, $100 million of rent, $40 million of utilities. Those are all at SJA 087 and SJA 122.
Counsel, the fact that Coles pays a lot of tax to Virginia isn't relevant if we apply the Oliver Twist principle. Thank you. May I have another? Which clearly is what's happening here. But let's get back to the issue of potential ambiguity. If we look outside of the statutory text, we are capable of looking at those budget bills. But before we look at the budget bills, the impact statement is, in fact, I believe, appropriate for us to look at in this particular instance. The committee that proposed the bill also guided the preparation of that impact statement. How does that does not play in your favor? If one looks at the impact statement only for purposes of interpreting the statute, it would appear to favor the department.
I don't think so, Your Honor. And two aspects to that. One is that impact statement isn't for the statute that was actually enacted. That was for a prior session, and our legislation was enacted during a special session, so the one for 1079.
I remember the special session well.
And the special session...
I still have the scars.
I'm sure. It was a hard-fought battle. It settled with the negotiations. But the statement that you are talking about talks about not paying tax in any state, and also companies that are formed in states where they don't pay any tax, not paying, there is no corporate income tax. That's just not the case here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument. Call the next case.